some points because he's now working on a PhD at George Mason and on U.S. China-Japan relations, but again on the region. So I'm sure we'll have lots of questions for you, but please join me in welcoming him before the forum.
Great. Well, thank you, Deepa. It is a real pleasure and a real treat to be here at my alma mater and to be in the podium this time instead of sitting where you're at. I'm very honored to be asked to speak, and I do think this is a very timely topic. Just in the past few weeks, we've seen President Trump express interest and taking another look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which, if you recall, he trashed. And one of the first things he did when he became president was to cancel the U.S. commitment to that. So it's a very striking change. Also, under President Trump, we've seen a national security strategy, a national defense strategy that labels China as a strategic competitor. Again, kind of a striking change from the early impressions observers had of President Trump and his interactions with Chinese President Xi Jinping, where they seemed to get along. And some people speculated maybe the deal cutter would cut the ultimate deal and find some way to avoid rivalry with China and come to some kind of understanding. On the Chinese side, of course, their leaders tend to be much more careful in their language than perhaps ours. But any casual observer of the Chinese media would notice that the past few years have featured a steady drumbeat of criticism of the United States and its leadership, especially in Asia. So there are tensions growing. Anybody who just looks at the news can see that there's a competition underway between China and the United States. And in fact, so many people have written on this topic, I confess I feel challenged to try and provide a new perspective. But I'm gonna try, and I'm gonna start with my bottom line up front, the points that I intend to make in this presentation. Number one, competition with China, between the U.S. and China, is unavoidable, I would argue, but conflict is not inevitable. It's perhaps not especially novel, but I think it deserves emphasis. Second point I want to make is that the competition is systemic. This is a point I want to touch on. The competition is not about particular issues like Taiwan or Korea. Those are maybe understood as symptoms of a deeper issue. The third point I want to make is that the competition is spanning both regional and global systemic levels. So this is a problem that's becoming intractable and difficult, and this is why I think it is at this point futile to try to hope the two countries can cooperate their way out of a competition. I just don't think it's realistic, and that at this point, and this is my last point I'll make in the briefing, the United States should accept the reality of this being a long-term competition and instead seek to try and manage it at a lower level of volatility. And I want to talk a little bit about that. So that's my bottom line up front. And hopefully we'll have a good dialogue through this talk. All right. So I want to start with looking at why this is a structural and systemic problem. This is not a problem of a few issues. That if you resolve those issues, the problem would go away. If we resolve Taiwan somehow, I don't think this competition would go away. Underpinning this issue is the reality that there is a growing parity between China and the U.S. This slide from the IMF using PPP, purchasing power parity, illustrates that China's economy has grown phenomenally, as we all know. Even in absolute terms, China is the second largest economy. If you don't use PPP, it's the second largest economy. And the gap between the U.S. and Chinese economic power has narrowed. But it's not just the size of China's economy, I think, that is important. It is the changing structure of the economy. In the 80s and 90s, the Chinese and U.S. economies were actually quite complementary in many ways. U.S. lent money to China and bought, U.S. consumers bought goods made at a very low price in China, and both sides benefited. But as China starts to outgrow this export-driven strategy like many other developing countries and moves up the value chain, the changing nature of its economy makes it more and more competitive with the U.S. China now has aspirations to be a technological leader. It wants to move up into more advanced manufacturing. It wants to move into services. All of these are areas that the U.S. has long specialized in and tried to maintain a leading edge when it shed its own labor-intensive manufacturing jobs. So the shape of the economies are starting to converge, and that's intensifying the competition. Moreover, the fact that China's economy is moving in this direction makes it imperative for economic growth to succeed, for China to have more and more a say in how norms and trade rules are determined. Again, because China's competing in similar products, not quite, but moving in that direction. It is not enough for China simply to depend on cheap labor to gain an advantage. It needs to have more of a say in how what are the tech standards for certain high-tech goods that are accepted worldwide? You know, who should have the say on that? These kind of norms and rules become more and more important for China as they have been for the U.S. So I think what we're seeing happen in these recent years is a manifestation of this deeper systemic competition, and it's spilling out across all domains. I mentioned the economic issues, and I have their alphabet soup of various acronyms, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. I'll just go over a few of them. But as China has more and more of a stake in how regional trade is arranged, it has become more active in promoting its vision for trade initiatives, economic initiatives, Belt and Road Initiative, BRI. China has put forward its own AIIB, Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, so that it has more say over how investment is allocated in Asia to better fit its needs. But the competition is not simply economic. The more China integrates its economy with Asia, the more it realizes it cannot afford to leave a lot of its interests vulnerable. So China has been active in promoting a security concept, and you have the Chinese president saying security in Asia should be managed by Asians. It's a clear challenge to the U.S. Traditional dominance of the security order. Politically, China has a different view of what values should be most important. They tend to prefer to emphasize political stability and economic security for people and downplay the importance of human rights and democracy. And obviously they have, as Xi Jinping said, are seeking to inject Chinese voices into rules and norms of the region. On the U.S. side, you see contrasting vision that has sharpened over time, most notably in the national security strategy. But even under President Obama, you can see a lot of these issues were already cropping up. The current iteration of the vision of security articulated by the U.S. government is that of a free and open Indo-Pacific. It features a leading role for allies and partnerships. China, by contrast, has criticized the concept of alliances. You guys recall that the U.S. was very reluctant to support the AIIB when it came out. The U.S. argued that there's already an Asia Development Bank and everybody should work through that. So the disagreement has continued with that issue. And then obviously different views about priorities for human rights and democracy. So to me, these are the deeper systemic differences. Is there are competing visions for how Asia should be, how it should evolve, its architecture, its institutions, its values, and the dispute issues that we see in the newspapers are really manifestations of these deeper differences. Taiwan, North Korea, South China Sea, trade, if you dig down through the language both sides are using, you see embedded in the narratives of both sides constant references to all these ideas. But the issue doesn't stop in Asia. As China has grown, its interests have expanded around the world. And its interest, China's interest in how international institutions and organizations are arrayed grows as well. This slide illustrates some of the economic and security interests that are expanding around the world. And these are posing real challenges to Chinese policymakers. And what we're seeing is that a lot of the ideas and concepts that I mentioned in the previous slide, the Chinese are repackaging them and exporting them to a global level and talking about similar principles, values, norms, rules, trade, trade organizations. These are also starting to manifest at a level beyond simply East Asia. So the regional competition that is underway is already migrating upwards to in many ways, a global competition between the two sides. And here's an important point I want to emphasize about this global competition. Obviously, the U.S.-China competition at the global level is not as intense at the regional level. The regional level is where Chinese strength is most advanced, and where it's thinking about institutions and norms and issues like that is most developed. It is still feeling its way at the global level. But exacerbating this problem is that the existing international order is fragmenting. The world is still grappling with stagnant growth, very slow growth, ever since the 2008 global economic crisis. The transnational threats seem, at this point, impossible to resolve, or at least the governments cannot find a way to deal with climate change or refugee flows or terrorist movements that are spreading. Syria is just a symptom of this broader problem of seemingly intractable problems, breakdown, and sclerotic institutions. And this informs China's thinking about the international system. This is part of the reason you're seeing such criticism in the Chinese press of U.S. leadership of the international order. The Chinese commentators often point out that things aren't working and that maybe it's time to think about things in a different way and try a new approach. Again, I don't want to oversell their desire to reform or change elements of the international order. They are strong supporters of the United Nations and participate in many UN PKO. They support world trade. But there are elements of the international order that they regard as dysfunctional, that don't seem to be working well. And they're increasingly willing to start offering their ideas about what to do differently. And the U.S., again, doesn't always agree. So there is this competing vision, even at the global level. To gain some additional perspective on the U.S.-China rivalry today, I would like to contrast the current competition with an earlier version. U.S.-China rivalry is not new. In the Cold War, there was actually a competition between U.S. and China, but it looked very differently from the one today for several reasons. First off, geographically, it was much more limited. It was confined mainly to China's periphery. Again, mainly because China simply did not have the strength to exert influence beyond its shores. It was a very poor, largely rural country in the 50s and in the 60s. Very different today. This is a wealthy, increasingly powerful country that can exert influence throughout the region and internationally, beyond Asia. The actual competition domains, I think, in the Cold War were limited, but also much more intense in some ways. The ideology contrast between China and the U.S. was very intense. You had a radical Maoist ideal that was very anti-West, anti-capitalist, and the U.S. was in the grips of its own Cold War mentality, to use a phrase that's actually very appropriate here. The U.S. Was opposed to communism and did its best to resist it, even to the point of arms, violent struggles that resulted in deaths in the tens of thousands of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Chinese in Korea and Vietnam, in Korea in particular. And today, by contrast, although the competition is more comprehensive, more systemic, I would argue, the disagreements in some areas are more muted. We disagree in the ideological domain. There's still quite a bit of overlap and agreement. You know, both sides agree generally market economics work better than Stalinist economies. UN is a good thing, and promoting world peace, countering transnational threats. There is quite a bit of convergence, even though there is still these disagreements and differences. The power relation, again, to harken back to a theme in this presentation, in the Cold War, this was a limiting factor in some ways of the escalation potential. The U.S. just was far more powerful than China, and perhaps led it to calculate it could escalate combat with China and North Korea, arguably. By contrast, today, the growing parity between the two countries, I think, is a good incentive for both sides to seek caution and restraint and making sure tensions do not escalate and get out of hand. And as I mentioned, kind of related to the intensity of the disputes, in the Cold War rivalry, there was war, there was open conflict with heavy loss of life. Thankfully today, despite there being some tensions, no doubt growing, you know, on many issues, they are of a far lower level of intensity, and to date our leaders have found ways to de-escalate crises such as the 1996 Taiwan crisis. And just to reiterate the kind of more muted aspect of the U.S.-China competition, it's worth remembering the deep interdependence of the two countries. Chinese FDIs is obviously increasing significantly. Their purchase of U.S. goods has increased. China is a very important market for U.S. agricultural goods and high-end manufacturing. In fact, I'm sure you saw cited in the newspaper stories about how farmers were among the first to criticize President Trump's threats to impose tariffs on China because they saw that such a policy would be very damaging to that whole sector of the U.S. economy. So the interdependence is, I think, a very encouraging aspect of this competition because it provides a very strong incentive for the two sides to find ways to manage the competition and keep it at a lower level of volatility. The stakes are just too high. Neither side can afford to allow the competition to escalate to major war. So I'm going to close up with some thoughts on what does this mean, and I look forward to some Q&A. In my view, I think at this point it is unrealistic to expect the U.S. and China to avoid competition. And all the proposals I've seen by scholars who offer a way out of competition, I think just are not feasible. As I've presented this briefing, the differences are systemic, they're deeply rooted, and it's ultimately one of leadership and influence at the regional level, but increasingly at the global level. For the U.S., my recommendation would be for the U.S. to increase its competitiveness. Science and technology leadership in particular is a critical determinant of future economic growth, and therefore, to the extent the U.S. can preserve its advantage, it will be essential for the competition. To the extent it loses that advantage, I think the situation becomes more dangerous because the Chinese will gain confidence that they should have increasingly larger leadership role, and the U.S. can be expected to resist that because of the strategic losses that will be entailed in such a switch of leadership. The U.S. has a huge advantage in diplomatic influence, partnerships, alliances. These should be strengthened. It's I think regrettable in some ways that some of the current U.S. policies have not valued those enough, because those are, I think, a huge advantage for the U.S. China approaches the international competition from a far weaker position with no allies and very few countries that it can really trust and certainly the ones that are in China's orbit are not especially the most desirable partners, North Korea and countries like that. However, I think it is important also to try to find ways to manage this at a lower level of intensity. As I mentioned, I do think the interdependence provides a foundation for this more stabilizing competition. Finding ways to increase cooperation, even as the U.S. steps up competition, I think will be essential to carrying out this strategy. The image that I think of is kind of like stepping on the brakes and the gas pedal at the same time. It's it sounds like it doesn't go anywhere, but it's in some ways better than the alternative. You hit the gas pedal off in one direction towards escalation of competition, you're headed to a crash, and that's, you don't want that. But if you keep your foot on the brake pedal, then the U.S. isn't going anywhere, and it could be surpassed by its competitors. That can entail big strategic losses as well. So it's both. In my analysis, the U.S. is better off trying to step up both at the same time. Especially important, I think, is the sentiment of the people of the China and the U.S. To the extent the U.S. leaders and Chinese leaders can refrain from encouraging a hostile sentiment towards the other country among the people, this is, I think, a very important thing that both sides should do, because once those images take hold, this enemy image takes hold among two peoples, it creates a powerful constituency for hostile policies and war and antagonism. And that limits the options of any leader, and is unfortunately a very strong incentive for countries to adapt more dangerous policies towards one another. And then the last point I would make is that I think it is important to balance the regional and global competition. How the U.S. manages issues at the regional level will affect the global competition. Again, even though the regional competition is far more advanced than the global one, China is still growing, and so there is room for the competition to expand and intensify. Just because there is a competition doesn't mean that the U.S. cannot work with China to try and find ways to ease tensions on some of these dispute issues, whether they be South China Sea, East China Sea, Taiwan. But it should be aware that if mismanaged, the implications could impact U.S. credibility and influence at the global level. And so there's going to have to be a careful balancing of those two levels of competition. Something I didn't put in the slides, but I thought of as I worked through the presentation. This is a competition that's also multilateral. The U.S. is not the only one who is competing with China. Japan has an even more advanced rivalry than the U.S., and that is bound to intensify as Chinese power continues to grow and as Japan continues to struggle to reboot its economy. And so coordinating, working with countries that are in their own competition with China is going to add a layer of complexity to efforts to manage this competition at a level of lower intensity, but it will be essential to keep the situation stable as this competition moves forward. So with that, I'm going to pause and then invite your questions.